Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jerry Groopman and Dr. Pam Hartspan, physicians and faculty members at Harvard Medical School, about their new book, Your Medical Mind Deciding What Is Right for You. I'm really interested in this.
I am too. But first, we've got some research that matters. We're going to talk about liposuction and belly fat.
About watching TV and the types of food you eat.
About bipolar symptoms in teens.
And about probiotics. And I think we're going to be probiotic.
I think we are. Let's talk about deep belly fat after liposuction.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't something that we would normally, I think, talk a whole lot on, Christy, on Your Health. But, you know, increasingly, a lot of women and men are doing cosmetic surgery. And a lot of people are doing liposuction. And I think they think that perhaps this is just a good way to take off extra fat.
And this is research looking at 36 normal weight women who had liposuction to take away a small amount of superficial fat who had been sedentary, to follow them after exercise and to see those who were sedentary and those who exercised what happened to their fat in their bodies.
Right. And I guess the concern was that maybe those who have the liposuction but then don't do any physical activity get a reoccurrence of this kind of deeper belly fat. That is very, very damaging to people. And so this was research that was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. That's a mouthful.
And they found that 4 months after the liposuction, women who'd remained sedentary still had the
Didn't exercise, uh-huh.
They did. They still had flatter tummies, but they had a gain of about 10% on average in visceral fat.
That's that deep fat, right?
Deep, deep fat that's not very good for you.
And in comparison, those who were exercising did not have this weight gain, which I think makes intuitive sense, but it's also a nice warning shot that, you know, if you have liposuction, you really need to combine it with exercise to prevent kind of something bad happening, which is a recurrence of this deeper bad fat.
Yeah, and I mean, it really highlights that liposuction is not a treatment for obesity, although it's used in cosmetic purposes along those lines, but it's not the answer to obesity.
Yes. Would you ever consider that, Christy?
Oh, everybody dreams of it, I think. Sounds wonderful, but no, I'll never do it.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do know a lot of patients do it, and this is a nice, and I think it's good for our cosmetic surgeons to bring this into their practices as well. Speaking of kind of practices, let's talk about our next research that matters about kids and the types of foods they eat as it relates to television.
Okay, so kids and teens who watch a lot of television, no surprise, but to me, they're less likely to get their fruits and veggies and more likely to snack on candy or drink soda every day. Looking at over 13,000 U.S. students in private and public schools across America.
Right, and this was published in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. And the question really is, you know, as they watch more TV, what happens with their actual vegetable consumption and junk food consumption? And it's pretty startling.
I mean, for each extra average hour of TV, that was linked to 18%, kids being 18% more likely to say they ate candy every day, 24% more likely to drink soda at least daily, and 14% more likely to go to fast food restaurants once a week or more.
And 5% less likely to eat vegetables. So kind of in total, whether it's because the advertisements for these types of foods are on the TV or because there's a nice sugar rush, you know, eating the junk foods, watching more and more TV isn't necessarily good for our kids.
And so the bottom line is to limit kids' television time, but also to make sure there are healthy snacks available. And if they're watching TV, offer them, cut up an apple or offer them something else they can munch on.
Or perhaps like my daughter does, Christy, she watches the shows that have Zumba and other sorts of, and puts the DVDs in and substitutes things that actually get you up and moving. I'd like to see more and more TV shows that get you up and moving out of your chair.
That
Come on now,
good.
Let's all get up and start moving.
Hey, okay.
Probably won't sell.
No. And what are we doing right now? We're sitting.
Okay, I'm going to start moving a little bit, but we have our very next research, Christy. that's about a serious topic, which is about bipolar disorder or manic depressive disorder and teenagers.
And this is looking at the number of teenagers who have experienced what's called mania. And that's sort of a hallmark of this bipolar disorder, where people have excessive energy, a lack of sleep, sometimes risky and impulsive behaviors, which I know a lot of teenagers do. But in this case, this is more of that sort of where it's out of control, excessive energy, and making risky choices.
In this research, in the Archives of General Psychiatry, where they followed over 10,000 teenagers and interviewed them about their moods and behavior, basically showed that half of the kids who might have this mania or bipolar disorder had not gotten treated yet. And, you know, the rate is probably the same as is in adults, but I think that there's an under-recognition of potentially how many teens really have this type of mood disorder that may benefit from treatment.
Yeah, I mean, it was about 2.5% met the criteria for having mania and depression. 2.2% of the teens had had it within the last 12 months. So, I mean, this suggests that the bipolar disorder is more common in teenagers than we thought. We sort of thought it always presents in adulthood, but it may be
right.
True
we're
that
maybe looking out for depression in kids, but a kid who's tons of energy that may actually be more than they should have, and they're not sleeping, there could be something underlying it, and then they might self-medicate. So we want our listeners out there to be aware of this and talk with your primary care doctor if you have concerns about your own child or a loved or a friend's child. Talk with them about it.
Okay, let's do our last house call, and that is about taking probiotics, or those gut-healthy microbes or bacteria that you can take to see if it helps prevent diarrhea with antibiotics.
Yes, this is what was called one of these systematic reviews published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where they looked at 63 trials and over 12,000 patients for those who were going to get antibiotics. And then they were either given this probiotic to try to prevent the complications of the antibiotics, or if they actually didn't get anything else in addition to antibiotics, a placebo.
And, I mean, up to a quarter or a third of people who typically get an antibiotic get diarrhea as a result of this. And so reducing that through taking the probiotics is a really significant thing to me.
And they found that the people who were prescribed this probiotic in all of these trials were 40% less likely to get diarrhea from their antibiotic drugs if they were given the probiotic. And this number needing to treat, you only need to treat 13 people with antibiotics who are taking a probiotic to prevent a case of diarrhea. That may sound like a lot of people, but actually in most things that we do, that's actually very impressive. Matter of fact, Christy, I wonder if we shouldn't, like, our standard of care shouldn't be that we recommend for almost every patient, because is there a downside to this?
Well, it's cheap. It costs 50 cents to a dollar a day. And so, I mean, in these times, any cost is significant to people, but it's relatively cheap to prevent diarrhea.
And pretty harmless. We don't know of any side effects from this. So I think we're going to be looking into this, and stay tuned. But if you're doing it, probably an okay thing. And if you're not, maybe that's something that we need to be having this conversation.
Okay. So we've talked about probiotics.
That we're very pro about.
Yes. About bipolar symptoms beginning in the teenager years.
About trying to really do something different than just sitting there and eating junk food while you're watching TV.
And about deep belly fat maybe increasing after liposuction if you don't change your life.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jerry Groopman and Dr. Pam Hartzman about their book, Your Medical Mind, How to Decide What is Right for You.
You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with oncologist Dr. Jerry Groopman and endocrinologist Dr. Pam Hartzband from the Harvard Medical School at Beth Israel Medical Center about their book, Your Medical Mind, How to Decide What is Right for You. We are so glad to have you with us, Drs. Grootman and Hartzband.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
It's a pleasure.
You know, we should really just kind of dive right in here. You guys are no stranger to publishing world. You've published in leading medical journals as well as Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and books. Tell us why you wrote this book at this point in time in your lives. How did this come about?
Well, we realized that there was a very powerful movement to standardize care in a sort of one-size-fits-all. And although there was a lot of lip service and a lot of mantra around patient-centered care and patient preferences, no one had ever really taught us as doctors how patient preferences are formed, what influences them, and really how to engage patients with language that will help them explain to us how they weigh risk and benefit.
And I'll just add to that that these days we're flooded with information about medical, with medical advice and information about medical matters. And I think everyone realizes now that experts can disagree.
And no. That's not allowed.
Exactly. So we wondered how patients make their decisions in the face of this kind of controversy.
Well, as you say, doctors are not usually taught in medical school or residency about why a patient might choose one treatment or another. And I wonder what you've discovered about what forces shape a person's view about medical care and their process of making decisions.
Well, in the process of thinking about this, we thought about William Osler, one of the most famous physicians of all times who practiced in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And he made the following statement, which I'm sure, Adam and Christy, you've heard, which is, when you're faced with a difficult medical diagnosis, listen to the patient, because if you know how to listen, he's telling you the answer. So we decided to listen to patients, and we went and asked people how they made their decisions. And we found that although there were people were very individual about how they made their decisions, there were common threads.
And can you give us an example? Give us an example of the types of listening that immediately come to mind.
So, for example, we found people who we call maximalists. And the maximalists want to be ahead of the curve, do everything and more, have the latest, greatest breakthroughs.
Are you talking about all of our patients in Chapel Hill?
And then we have the opposite kind of patient, the minimalist, who wants to just take the least amount of medication that is necessary. And we found, in fact, in ourselves that Jerry is a maximalist and I'm a minimalist.
Huh, interesting.
And what impact do personal stories of that patients have of their family members or their friends or loved ones, how do the personal stories and context of one's culture sort of weave into shaping someone to be a maximalist or a minimalist, as you say?
Well, part of it is the way you're raised. So it's your family and the way your family often viewed medicine and doctors. So as a maximalist, doctors in my family were on a pedestal. I came from a sort of traditional Eastern European Jewish family where whatever the doctor said goes, and every medication, every procedure was immediately assumed to mean better health. And also experiences of loved ones. My father, when he was in his 50s, had a massive heart attack and died. And he did not get intensive interventions. He did not get cutting-edge treatments. Now, he may have died anyway, but that loss strongly influenced my belief in doing everything to the maximum.
And I had a different kind of upbringing, And I'll just give you an example that I was the first child in my family, and when I was a baby, the doctor explained to my parents that the new scientific way to feed a baby was every 4 hours by the clock. And my dad, who was an engineer, was very enthusiastic about applying scientific principles to child rearing. So he made a chart, a very nice chart, so that my mother could check off every 4 hours when she fed the baby, and then he went to work. And my mother didn't have a very good time, hearing a lot of screaming, and finally took matters into her own hands and fed me when she thought I was hungry. And when my dad came home, he said, well, how can you not follow the advice of the experts, the doctors?
Who were wrong.
Her response was, well, doctors don't know everything.
We're talking with Dr. Jerome Groopman and Dr. Pam Hartzman from Harvard Medical School about their new book, Your Medical Mind, Deciding What's Right for You. And listening to the two of you describe some backgrounds and experiences, and thinking in your book, you really talk about this role of personal stories and how those influence decision-making, and how decision-making is influenced by family members, friends, or colleagues. Share with us if you think that that's a problem, or how that plays out in ways that can be improved through the types of things you write about.
Well, stories can be both good and bad. So what happens is when you hear a very powerful story, for example, you're given a medication. We talk about a woman in our book who was given a statin medication for high cholesterol. And she fell into the minimalist category. She didn't really want to take medicine unless she absolutely had to. And then she went to a church dinner, and there she saw an acquaintance who was hobbling around looking very ill and uncomfortable. And it turned out that this acquaintance had been given the very same medication that she had been prescribed and had developed a side effect from this medication, myopathy, muscle pain and inflammation, the most common side effect of this type of medication. And that story had a powerful effect on her. And in fact, these kinds of stories have powerful effects on all of us, doctors and patients alike, making you feel that something that is rare might be more likely to happen to you than it really is. And cognitive scientists call this availability, because the powerful story stays in your mind and is readily available.
Well, let me ask a question, Dr. Groopman. You're an oncologist, correct?
Yes.
So in the cancer world, this happens, I can imagine, a lot, where people's impressions are formed by their family and friends. Knowing what you know and writing how you write, how do you approach then those who might not want to do one of the therapies that you think should be done?
Well, first, for example, I had a man who had a lymphoma, which is a very treatable kind of cancer, potentially curable, and he absolutely refused chemotherapy. And he was a veteran and so on, and I kept trying to get at the roots of it, and it turned out that one of his army buddies had chemotherapy and died. But it turned out that the cancer that he had was a lung cancer, which, of course, is much harder to treat and is not curable. And so the experience, the story of his friend, was misleading him. And by spending the time to elicit the story, to explain the difference between his case and his friend's case, and the differences in the chemotherapy, we ultimately came to an understanding, and he was treated, and actually he's been in complete remission for more than a decade now. So I think that, you know, doctors should be aware of the power of stories and then put the stories in context. But as Pam said also, you know, stories can be very good because, you know, you tell a man, for example, contemplating the options for prostate cancer, which is very debated, and the experts disagree about what's best to do. And by talking to other men who have had the different therapies, that individual man who's trying to choose can get a concrete, sort of palpable sense of what life might be like with regard to post-surgery or post-radiation or what's called watchful waiting, active surveillance, without any intervention.
We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guests, Dr. Jerry Groopman and Pam Hartsband, about their book, Your Medical Mind, How to Decide What is Right for You. Looking forward to further conversation. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Drs. Jerry Groopman and Pam Hartsband from Harvard Medical School about their book, Your Medical Mind, How to Decide What is Right for You. Before the break, we were talking about the value of stories and the way that patients really grab onto stories and relate to stories of their loved ones or people that they know. And, you know, it strikes me, and I know you discuss this a bit in your book, about how much doctors talk about statistics and risks and, you know, all these sort of higher order complicated terms that can be twisted to present your case one way or another. But yet how a story really captures a person's heart. Everybody understands that. And I wonder, how does health literacy and understanding risks and statistics play into a person's experience and ability to make wise decisions?
Well, I think that people are often intimidated by statistics and numbers, but one of my teachers in medical school, who was a woman neurologist who came from West Virginia and had some, you know, very deep common sense wisdom, she said, you know, medicine is not physics, advanced physics. There's nothing in medicine that's so complicated that it can't be explained to virtually anyone. And it's really the job of the doctor to have that language. And one of the things we found is that people are misled by numbers because of what's called framing. So, for example, you might say to someone, we were talking before about the woman who went to church and saw a friend who had a side effect, muscle pain and so on. And that can occur in between 1 to 10% of people who take a statin. Now, 10%, that sounds like a high number. But if you flip the frame and you say between 90 and 99% of people don't have a side effect, that sounds much more reassuring, even though the information is identical.
Yeah, but we don't talk about that, though. We don't say, everyone in church who's taking a statin, please raise your hand. And those of you who are not having side effects, keep your hands still up, right? I mean, but that would be the reality of that type of similar analogy for the healthy well.
That's true. And, of course, people who have a side effect or something negative happen to them usually tell, on average, I think, 10 people, whereas somebody who's doing fine might tell 2. So you tend to hear the more negative stories more often.
But you're talking about that you can reframe that. Well, in your book, you also talk about, if you're talking about, you know, as patients, there are lots of times difficult, many complex issues and not a lot of time frame, and they may hear different opinions. What do you do with this, what you call decisional conflict? What's that about, and what do you recommend?
First is, I think, decisional conflict means that a patient can't make a choice because they feel torn in two different directions. We opened the book, actually, with a man who has a heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation, and he is trying to decide whether he should have his blood thinned with a so-called anticoagulant. On the one hand, he is at risk for a stroke because a clot could form in the heart and go to the brain. On the other hand, the medication to prevent that can cause bleeding, can cause even a fatal hemorrhage. And he had a neighbor who suffered a severe hemorrhage on this medication. So he was paralyzed. And so what we try to do is to first recognize it and also acknowledge that it's understandable, because medicine is often in a gray zone. It's not black and white, that it's absolutely clear that this is right and this is wrong. So what we try to do is both present the numbers and then try to get him, using the discovery we made in the book from talking to patients, are you a maximalist, a minimalist, or a believer, or a doubter? How do you weigh risk and benefit to choose between these two options, which is no treatment and potentially risk a stroke, even though it's a small percentage of people, versus taking a blood thinner and risking bleeding?
Well, and I can imagine that's very stressful. I know it is for many of my patients facing a big decision like that when you're getting maybe conflicting advice from family members or unclear. It's in that gray zone that causes a lot of stress. And you talk a bit about the role of the physician to listen to the patient and really help the patient understand their values versus just sort of making that hard line recommendation for those times when it's muddier. What can we learn about for physicians to really listen well or to help frame that in the best decision for them considering their values? A lot of patients just say, well, just tell me what to do, or what would you do? Tell me your story.
Right. Well, what would you do? I think that's a very common question that we get asked as physicians. And one of the important things to realize is that physicians have their own sort of medical mindsets, if you will. Some of them are maximalists and believers, and others might be minimalists and doubters, mm-hmm. using the categories that we discuss in the book. And in fact, Jerry is a maximalist and believer, and I tend to be a minimalist and a doubter. And this is going to color our own personal choices, but also how we tend to present advice to patients. So what we hope is that doctors will be able to think about their own mindset and be able to understand that a patient's choice may differ from their own and still be perfectly rational and reasonable because it's according to their own values and preferences and how they weigh risk and benefit.
And so how do you respond to that question, what would you do?
Well, I'll give you a little vignette. So as an endocrinologist, I frequently see patients with thyroid nodules. And as you know, these are very common and they're usually benign, but some percentage will be malignant. And so to make a diagnosis, we usually do a needle biopsy. But sometimes after doing one or even several biopsies, you can't get enough cells to make a diagnosis. And therefore, you have to decide if you're going to go ahead and do surgery. So I recently saw a woman who was in this situation. She had a thyroid nodule, and she had 3 biopsies, and we couldn't get enough cells. And so we had to talk about the issue of surgery or no surgery. And she said to me, well, what would you do? So I said to her, well, if it were me, I would watch and wait. But if it were my husband, Dr. Groopman, he would have had surgery yesterday. We have different medical mindsets.
Wow, that's a great example. And talking with Dr. Jerome Groopman and Dr. Pamela Hartzman about their book, Your Medical Mind, and you know, listening to you all, you would almost think that perhaps you guys would be perfect matches together. I understand you actually are married.
That is true. 32 years. But it
sounds like you complement one another well, and I think we want to compliment you both for writing what Christy and I feel is an important book for patients, for generalists, for specialists, for patient empowerment in general. And we encourage our listeners to get a copy of the book themselves, and to help them and help all of us in this really critical dialogue. So thank you so much for being with us today on Your Health.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
Chrissy, listeners can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we hope they'll download our health application by searching for Your Health, all one word, for a free download at the Apple iTunes Store or the Android Store, and just send us questions through telephone or by email.
And now we're going to take our very first house call of the day. We've got some about depression, blood pressure, insomnia, or sleeping problems, and about heart tests. So let's take our very first house call question.
I am tired all the time, and my doctor said after doing blood work that I was okay, but that I was depressed. The issue, however, is that I do not feel depressed, and I do not want to take a medicine that has so many side effects. I am really overweight, and I wonder if I might have sleep apnea, and if that could be causing my problem.
Well, thank you for sending us that particular question, because I think this is an issue that is perhaps more common than a lot of times we talk about, which is, you know, we kind of jump sometimes to thinking people are depressed when they have depressive symptoms.
Well, and that's partly because we know that depression is actually still under-recognized and under-treated. And so I think kudos to your doctor for at least considering depression as a reason for being tired. But it sounds like you have some disagreement with the doctor.
Yeah, and not all depression is really depression. And so sometimes we oftentimes think about thyroid disease.
Or anemia.
A possibility for being tired. I don't think all of our colleagues, and certainly maybe not even myself, Chrissy, kind of think about sleep apnea as commonly presenting with fatigue, depression.
Daytime fatigue. I tell you, my daughter had some sleep apnea, and it was her daytime tiredness, despite 13 hours of sleep and all that snoring, that made me finally like, I guess we should do something about that.
Yeah, well, and hopefully she didn't get treated for depression, but you could easily see that. And I think getting a workup, if you have risk factors, that you might have risk factors here for sleep apnea, to see if that's causing a problem is reasonable. And by the way, sleep apnea, if you had it, I mean, and you got really fatigued, maybe you feel depressed from that fatigue, not that the depression is causing the fatigue.
And losing weight would be a good step for that. So I would recommend you go back to your doctor and say, okay, I would like for us to consider some things other than depression, and let's talk about all the possibilities for being tired.
Well, our guests today, Dr. Groopman and Dr. Hartzman, when they were talking about kind of your medical mind and deciding what's right for you, you know, this is right in line with what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your very question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
My father has really high blood pressure, and he is on 4 different medications just to control it. He has to get off many of them because he said that there are so many side effects. Can you tell me what are the most common blood pressure medicines and what are their side effects?
This is a tough one to do quickly, but Adam and I, we should, just on all these different blood pressure medicines. One of the most common first-line medicines for blood pressure is called a diuretic, or something like HCTZ, or there's chlorthalidone. There's a couple different ones that are very inexpensive, very well-tested. Potential
and
side effects.
I'll tell you, Chrissy, you list the medicines.
Okay.
Side effects here, impotence, number one. Number two, impotence. at least a lot of the patients I see, it's well-tolerated, but some people feel drained. You got to get up at night sometimes to urinate. Okay.
Okay, I want to do more.
Short
we don't
trip.
Have time for this. Okay, the next one, next option would be something called a beta blocker, which is often used in people with heart problems or if you've had a heart attack, and it can be a good medicine for blood pressure as well.
Yep. Sometimes these patients actually do feel sometimes tired or depressed and sometimes impotent.
Another
you're going to see a common theme here, and sometimes you don't want to take any of these medicines, but these are really good medicines, really.
Okay, another one is an ACE inhibitor.
That's a kidney, kind of works at the level of the kidneys.
It does, and it's really good to protect your kidneys if you have diabetes or other potential kidney problems.
And we don't hear too much about impotence with that one, but if you're allergic to it, which we hear sometimes about, they can have their tongue swell. And then sometimes you have to watch out that you have to watch the kidneys.
Another one is a calcium channel blocker.
And sometimes people get constipated and their ankles swell.
Mm-hmm.
So good medicines, we really do need to do a whole show. We get Dr. Vieira here, one of the national experts and one of the family physicians in our department.
And I just have to say, Adam said impotence a lot. It is, these medicines, if you have high blood pressure, are really important to lowering your blood pressure and helping prevent heart attacks and strokes. And so it's important to work with your doctor to try to minimize side effects, but don't just stop taking them all of a sudden, because that really could do damage over time.
If you have the side effects, talk to your doctor, because yes, several of these did not, and there's lots of other ones too. Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen to our next house call.
I have bad insomnia, and I was taking Benadryl that helped, but it makes me so drowsy. My doctor recommended either Elavil, Trazodone, or Ambien. What do you think?
Lots of options.
Oh, I'm getting kind of drowsy here, Chrissy.
Okay, yes.
And I didn't take the Benadryl, but boy, if you take Benadryl, it can make you drowsy for sleep, but also for the next day.
It makes me tired the next day.
That's right.
Well, one thing I'd say is don't forget to start with just good sleep hygiene. Going to bed at the same time. You know, we'll put up a few tips on our blog. Our health sciences librarians could put up some good links for us about tips for sleep hygiene.
Excellent idea. Like, give us one tip.
Go to sleep at the same time every night. Use your bed only for sleeping and not for TV watching.
Yeah,
don't watch
Law and Order in the SVU and Child.
Having the lights out, going to sleep at the same time and waking up at the same time as much as possible. Exercise.
And the reality is, any of these medicines actually have their place for the right patient at the right place in the right time, any of them could be okay to use. So
the Elavil, you know, and the Trazodone are a whole lot cheaper than the Ambien and have less sort of addictive dependence.
And they all
properties.
Have side effects that are ones that have to review. So I'm not sure we can say which one that we would recommend. I'd start with what Christy recommended as the very first place.
All right, let's take our last house call question.
I'm a longtime smoker, but I do want to quit. Recently, I tried an exercise class, but I found I could not even breathe. Do you think I have heart disease, and should I have a heart test?
Well, congratulations for wanting to quit and for trying an exercise class. Those are two very positive steps for your health.
And we're sorry, though, that you couldn't breathe when you went to the exercise class. And do we think you have heart disease? Well, I'm not so sure you have heart disease. I mean, depending on your age and risk factors, you know, some people might recommend that you do a stress test before you get into an exercise program, but I do worry whether or not you might have some underlying lung disease.
I would go see your doctor and talk about, the doctor's going to ask questions about chest pain or other breathing related problems when you're exercising. And most likely, quitting smoking is the most important thing you can do for yourself. And then working up, if you went to a hardcore exercise class, sometimes just from going a long time without exercising, you can have a hard time breathing. So I would say go talk to your doctor and also sort of start slow and gradually work up.
Yeah, and even if you have some pulmonary or lung disease, actually a pulmonary rehab program or cardiovascular, maybe your insurance would even pay for it. A nice way of getting that exercise structured. So thank you so much for all of your questions today.
Great. We've talked a little bit about heart or breath tests to help if you're getting back into exercise.
And the sleep apnea, possibly relating to depression and fatigue.
About insomnia and different treatment steps.
And finally, high blood pressure and good medicines, but also be careful about the side effects.
Thanks for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed some things that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our new health app. You can just search Your Health for a free download on iTunes.
Let us know what you think. We'd like to thank WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dr. Jerry Groopman and Dr. Pam Hartzband.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.